was funny when I could do it the second time, because now you know what I'm going to do.
You are listening to A Scary State, and this week we're talking about Illinois. So, Lauren?
Yes, Kenzie.
Let's get scary.
How many times do we think Mackenzie's going to say Illinois?
I didn't. I just said Illinois.
One for one.
Mm-hmm. Guess what? You got to read the state facts, so I really can kind of get out of it, and I don't really say it in my story on purpose. But I have to tell you something.
Okay.
You might not believe me. You might not think this is a true story.
Okay.
Over the weekend, I was in Charlotte celebrating a friend's birthday. And we started out the day going to her brother's house with his fiance, and we had like a brunch.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it wasn't hot, it was warm.
Uh-huh.
And so I had to cool down my face before I could eat. So by the time I cooled down my face and was ready to eat, there were only tater tots left. So I had a piece of bacon, some tater tots, and a couple strawberries.
So how long did it take you to cool down your face?
Well, when we got there, the food was essentially ready, and so everyone got their food. And I just sat at the table for, like, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes.
Why don't you just grab your food and put it in the plate in front of you and then just wait?
I wanted to stop my face from...
Ew. Okay.
I got, like, a plate without any food on it and just started fanning myself. I was like, I just need the fan for my face. But later on, I was hungry. So we went to the next bar, and there were two food trucks. One was like a chicken something or other, and the other one was like a hot dog stand. And I was like, there's a higher chance that I'll like the hot dog over the chicken. So I got a hot dog, ate it in its entirety.
Normally.
With, unfortunately, no one to congratulate me because none of the people I was with knew about my thing. And
I would have looked at you so weird, and I would have been like,
and
because for people who don't know, Mackenzie will not eat a hot dog as like a whole thing, like with the hot dog and the bun. How do you eat it, Mackenzie?
I eat the hot dog and then I'll eat the bun. It's the same way I used to eat sandwiches. We take apart the sandwich and eat the stuff that was inside the sandwich and then eat the bread.
So odd.
Well, I had a traumatic experience as a child, and my young brain associated the fact that I threw up after eating a hot dog because it was in a bun.
That's why I can't eat chocolate ice cream.
So,
mm-hmm.
I never did it again, and then I was too afraid after that, and then I was like, I don't think I'm even going to like it.
So you trusted to eat a hot dog this way while you were out drinking.
I was fucking starving. I was so... This was the best hot dog I ever had in my entire life.
And did you get sick afterwards?
No, because I was so hungry.
But look at how amazing that is. So now you can eat hot dogs normally.
Well, it stopped being about that I was afraid I was going to throw up and started being about, I don't think I'm going to like this because I've never...
Done them together?
Done them together.
How did you like it?
I still prefer it separate. I felt like I was eating like two things at once.
Well, yeah, a lot of food is like that.
Yeah, but like not in like that way, like not in the beautifully blended kind of way of food, like two separate things.
Okay.
And it was fine in the moment because I was so hungry and it was like, this is a gift from God and I know it's not even kosher.
Because you follow kosher.
I try, at least when it comes to hot dogs, because that shit is nasty.
Yeah.
But I was just really proud of myself for doing that.
I'm really proud of
and
you.
And keeping it to myself up until I talked to you and my mom, because no one else would give me the congratulations that I feel like I deserve.
I'm very proud.
Thank you. Thank you. I was really proud of myself, too, and I had to give myself a
little pat on the back.
A little pat on the back. There was something else I wanted to tell you. Okay. So last night I was laying in bed doing my little word search, finished my word search book, by the way.
Oh.
And I heard a door slam. And you can always hear the door slam in my apartment building, whether it's the door outside or someone's door. But it seemed like loud.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, huh? If I didn't know better, I would think that someone came in my house. Thinking it's just like a next door neighbor and that's why it's so loud. So, go to bed. Like, I don't hear anything else after the slam.
Uh-huh.
Wake up this morning and have a notification from the app that I use to, like, lock and unlock my door.
Uh-huh.
And it was, like, maintenance request completed, you know, taking away the access or whatever that maintenance has. 12:53 a.m. And I was like, did someone fucking come into my apartment? So this
don't like that.
Right.
Were you awake at 12:53?
No.
Oh.
I was asleep by then.
Oh.
Which is why I was like even more nervous that like the slam I heard earlier was them coming in. And then like the 53 was them, because it was a little after midnight when I heard, I don't know what time it was. I didn't look at my watch, but I know it was after midnight. And so in my head, I'm like, oh, well, whenever I heard it, then they were in there for that time
oh.
and left. So this morning, I walk out, have my little knife with me. I'm like holding it. I'm like, this looks stupid. But it makes me feel badass.
Right. Like, I would never, I don't think I could actually use it.
Right.
But having it just makes
me
feel
better. In my mind, they're not expecting this.
They're not expecting me.
And so, like, thankfully, God bless the heavens, because the door didn't creak when I slowly opened it. So I could, like, really kind of get a good look out just to make sure. So I walk out. No one's there, obviously.
Obviously.
But then, like, I closed all the curtains and I shined a flashlight everywhere, because then I was paranoid that some sicko came in and, like,
with
put
cameras?
A camera.
Was your front door locked?
Yes. It
oh,
was locked.
Okay.
So then I checked the activity, and the last activity was when I unlocked it and came back in. And that was like when I went to go check the mail.
Right.
But when I looked at the notifications, there it was. And so I screenshot everything. I went on to the portal and sent a message. And I was like, I am sure that this is most likely a glitch in the app or whatever, but I'm letting you know just in case it's not. Here's what happened. I couldn't attach a picture, so I was like, you can email me if you want a picture. But
did they say anything?
So he got back to me and he was like, I'm so sorry for the confusion. They were doing like a reset and getting rid of any open whatever that they still had.
Yeah.
And so no one actually came in. It was just whenever the company or whatever did the reset. That's why that time was then.
Oh, my God.
And I put in there multiple times. I was like, I know this is probably a technical error, but, like, please just make sure.
For my peace of mind, right. Please.
I was like, I'm not trying to be psycho, but, like, I need to know for sure.
Right. I need the answers.
Yes. And so that's what it was.
Oh, I don't like that.
I didn't either. And, like, I decided that I'm going to put a chair
in front of your door?
In front of my door, because if you open it, the chair will squeak. It's like a heavy chair, so it'll squeak across the ground.
I mean, that's kind of smart.
Yeah. I'm glad I closed my door now. But yeah, so that happened. Oh, and did you know that there's a difference between coffin and casket?
Oh.
So even though, yes, they're technically used for the same thing, the coffin is what you think of when you think like Dracula.
Yeah.
And then a casket is what you think of when you think like going to a regular funeral.
Yeah.
Which, as soon as I heard it, I was like, well, okay. I think that's what people do anyway.
Yeah.
I just didn't know that, like...
Like, I wouldn't say, like, oh, they're going to be buried in their coffin.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, for sure. But, like, I never thought about them as actually being separate things.
Yeah. You know, like, I mean? Know they're separate things, but yeah. I never thought of them as separate things.
So, found that out on how it's made when I was
oh.
up at 5 a.m. I was like, okay. I said it to myself, like, a million times. I was like, you have to remember to tell Lauren. Have to remember to tell Lauren.
Very fascinating.
I remembered.
You remembered.
And that's all she wrote. Those are all the things I have to tell you.
I literally don't have anything to tell you other than our neighbors suck. And yeah, I don't know if you heard it when we were recording all the banging that was going on. You don't know if that was from them or not. Well, if it happens again, I'll let you know, because then you'll hear me bang my water bottle on the ground. So I'm overplaying nice.
I'm probably never going to hear it.
Oh, I'll point it out. Don't you worry.
See, as I'm retelling you this story of this intruder that I thought was in there, I'm like, I know too many things. Like, I was talking to my mom yesterday, and she was talking about wanting to get apples. So I told her about our fun little fact that we found out about apples.
Mm-hmm.
She knew, apparently, instantly.
Oh, yeah.
And so I told her, like, the plan, or a plan that one could possibly do.
Because we don't have a plan for who.
No, no, no.
No, it's just a plan.
All hypothetical. For educational purposes only. And so I asked her why a peach pit, like, I know, again, you can't eat a peach pit, but I don't know why. Like, is there something, is it cyanide, like the apple seeds? Like,
oh.
What is it? And she's like, it's either that or hemlock. And I was like, oh, that's untraceable. And she was like silent for a second. And she was like, I mean, well, how do you know that? And I was like, I watch a lot of true crime and I watch a lot of crime shows. And she's like,
and you just pick up on things.
Right. And she's like, well, I didn't know that. And that's not why I was saying it. I think that's just what's in it. I was like, oh, okay.
But now you know.
But now you know.
Oh, that is interesting.
And so I was
on both counts
thinking to fucking check for mini cameras in my vents.
I know.
Like, oh my God.
Oh, this has done a lot to us.
I don't know if it's like good because now I'm prepared or if I'm paranoid.
My first thought with our noisy neighbors was that something nefarious is going on. So other people think, oh, you know, what is causing that noise? And here I am like, well, I can think of about three things that it could be caused. And I was like at work and I said, yeah, like what if like that you can get that noise from throwing someone up against a wall? And my coworker was like, how do you know the noise of someone getting thrown up against a wall? Like, I don't, but I can figure.
Oh, man. Okay.
Okay.
Now that's all the updates I have.
All right. So let me get into the state facts for what state, Mackenzie?
Illinois.
Yeah, good job. Thank you. Okay. Waterfalls in Illinois. Only out-of-staters are surprised by the waterfalls created by the spring thaw and rain in the 18 canyons of the sadly named Starved Rock State Park. I did not know there were waterfalls either.
Me neither.
According to legend dating to the 1760s, the chief of the Illinois tribe stabbed the chief of the Ottawa tribe during a tribal council meeting in the area. The Ottawa clan launched an attack on Illinois, whose members escaped to the Great Rock in the park but died of starvation there. Formed by stream erosion and glacier melt, the canyons located about 90 miles west of Chicago cut through 4 miles of sandstone bluffs. Try any number of scenic park hikes to explore terrain dating back hundreds of millions of years. Bald eagles arrive in late December, and there's always an Eagle Watch weekend in January. Don't worry if that sounds too cold for you. The magnificent birds tend to stay until March.
Which also sounds too cold.
Apparently, I think it's the DC Zoo. They have, like, their eagle couple, and they have it called the power couple. So they're the power couple eagles. They have some little babies.
I don't know if it's that same one, but this podcast I listened to was talking about some Eagle Watch.
Oh.
Apparently, like, ravens came in and fucked. I don't know if it's the same one.
No, not know. The power couple.
I don't know if it's the same one or if there's, like, a different Eagle Watch for eagles somewhere else.
There's probably a ton of Eagle Watches.
But she just said Eagle Watch, and I don't remember.
Nasty ravens.
Yeah, and, like, that manatee that, like, was, or not manatee, manta ray in Charlotte in the aquarium. Well, for a little bit there was speculation that she either...
What happened?
I'm telling you. whatever that term is when, like, an animal can, like, produce its offspring by itself.
Ovovivipores. No.
I don't know. Whatever that's called, they thought it was either that or, like, she might have gotten pregnant by, like, a shark that was in the same tank. And so we were like, whoa. And come and find out that... whatever that process is that I was referring to earlier that I don't know the name of, there's a likely chance that the babies are not going to come to fruition. Aww. And apparently they said the same thing about the eagle eggs because they might not have been, like, not fertilized. That's the right word.
Yeah, I think so.
It just sounds weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fertilized.
Yeah.
Sounds like gardening. And so it was, so no babies.
Well, hopefully there were no babies so that if the ravens ate them, it was just eggs.
Yeah.
Well, sad.
Sally.
Wow, we're just on a roll. Sad things.
I'm not going to change it for my story either.
Oh, my story changes it. So we're good.
Okay. Well, that's a good thing that you're ending.
Yes. Archaeologists aren't sure when the first people arrived in what's now Illinois. Most archaeologists have uncovered ancient spear points and tools, suggesting that humans lived here at least 10,000 years ago. Illinois' first known Native American tribes, which include the Miami and the Illiniwek, also known as the Illinois, lived on the land thousands of years later. The Gulf Coastal Plain is a hilly area at the state's southern tip. It's sometimes nicknamed Egypt because it's similar to the Egyptian Nile's fertile delta. Interesting. With 80% of Illinois being farmland, the fertile soil is one of the state's best natural resources. Some of Illinois' top crops are corn, soybeans, and apples. There's a lot of apples. Yeah, the top crops, top crops. And the state's official snack food is popcorn, which can be served Chicago style. That's a mixture of cheese-covered and caramel-covered popcorn. With over 333 farms growing corn, it's no wonder that popcorn is the snack of choice. Would you eat it?
Hmm?
Would you try that popcorn, the Chicago style?
100%.
With the cheese and the caramel?
Well, I like kettle corn.
I love kettle corn.
So I figure It'll be like a sweet, salty thing.
I love the salted kettle corn.
Yeah.
Ooh, that stuff's good.
I'm not willing to buy my own. I am willing to try it.
When someone has some, you're like, let me have some.
Correct.
Yep.
Correct. Okay. And then that will be the decision of whether or not I get my own.
There we go. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Chicago's Museum of Science and Industry contains the world's largest pinball machine and a miniature castle. Fun. One of the flattest states in America is Illinois. The highest natural point in the state is known as Charles Mound, where it reaches 1,235 feet above sea level.
It's literally just like a hill.
Just a mound.
Yeah, just a hill.
My friend warned me when we drove down to Arkansas, we passed through Illinois, and she was like, it's going to be so flat. And sure enough.
It's flat as fuck.
So much farmland. And I looked at Joe, I said, wow, what a state. The Kaskaskia Dragon is a 35-foot metal monster that breathes actual fire. Built in 1995 by a local hardware store, the dragon started out as a parade float, but then later became an iconic roadside attraction. We did not see this dragon. The Willis Tower in Chicago, Illinois, is the third largest building in the United States. It's also weird to think that Chicago is part of Illinois. You know
yes,
what I mean?
Yes, all the time.
Yeah, like it doesn't, like I obviously know
it's
it is.
It's the same way that like New Orleans is part of Louisiana.
Yeah.
It just doesn't.
That one makes more sense to me though than Chicago and Illinois for some reason.
Yes, but it's still the same vibes. Like when you go outside of New Orleans into Louisiana, you are in a different place.
Yeah.
Like they are not the same.
It's like there's a big difference between like, oh, where are you going this weekend? Illinois. Or where are you going this weekend? Chicago.
Right. Like you wouldn't say, if you're going to Chicago, you would say Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's definitely weird. I mm-hmm. always forget it.
So this Willis Tower is a skyscraper that is 108 stories high and stands 1,450 feet tall. The Willis Tower features the Sky Deck, which is the highest observation deck in America. On a clear day, visibility from the Sky Deck offers views of four states, Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, and Michigan, for as far as 50 miles. That's really high up, mm-hmm. and I don't think I could do it.
Mm-mm.
Cue up the theme from The Simpsons, because Illinois generates more nuclear energy than anywhere else in the United States. The Prairie State is home to 11 nuclear power reactors across 6 power plants, which produce half the state's electricity. Wow. Illinois grows the largest amount of pumpkins in the world. In fact, the small town of Morton is known as the pumpkin capital of the world and hosts a pumpkin festival every year. We should go.
Mm-hmm.
Libby's, if you've ever made a pumpkin pie with canned pumpkin, you've likely used Libby's, plants 5,000 acres worth of pumpkins each year in Morton, as well as processes about 80% of the world's canned pumpkins at its factory.
What? 5,000 acres.
Oh, you shook your head and I said, what did I read wrong?
No, nothing. I would have said something out loud if you read something wrong.
No, 5,000 acres is that's just a lot of pumpkins.
I was shaking my head at like the, it's crazy.
I would love to see it during like September, October time when they're all like fully like pumpkins.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just all the orange.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah. Until 1900, the Chicago River flowed its natural route from inland into Lake Michigan. However, the flow was reversed by engineers so that water waste wouldn't enter the lake. Now Lake Michigan flows into the city instead. That's cool. Do that. I don't know.
Well, according to my calculator, I have no fucking idea.
Three.
My question was going to be, do you say route or route?
I don't know.
I think it's situational. Like I
yeah.
say route 66 and,
yeah.
you know, not route 66. But here I would have said natural route. Natural route?
Natural route. Natural
no,
route.
No, you said route.
Huh. I don't know. I did not even think into it that much where yeah. I would know what I say. Robert Wadlow was born in Alton, Illinois in 1918, where he was raised and became known as the Giant of Illinois and the Alton Giant. Wadlow's height was a staggering 8 feet 11 inches due to an unusually high amount of human growth hormone that his body produced. He died in 1940, but remains the tallest man ever known in history, and a life-size statue in Alton commemorates his life. I would come up to, like, his hip.
You remember Ripley's Believe It or Not?
Yeah.
That guy.
Okay, I've stood next to him.
Yeah.
Obviously.
If you've been in a Ripley's Believe It or Not, you have seen this man.
Yep, that's who I thought immediately.
Yes, that's who it is.
Yeah, come up to his like hip.
Yeah.
According to the Illinois Secretary of State's office, a driver cannot have a vanity license plate that says Uranus. The planet's name was added to the Uranus?
This is Uranus.
I mean, you can say Uranus, but as a teacher, you'd be screwed because then you'd have a million children laughing at you.
I know, but I don't have children here, so. The planet's name was added to the 2023 list of permanently banned personalized and vanity plates in the state. What are other ones?
Probably things like fuck. Shit like that.
There was a place on our trip to Arkansas that was Uranus, and it was like a little town you could stop in. So we stopped in there, and you can get fudge from there. And it says, like, I got my fudge from Uranus. It was a really cute little area. It had the biggest belt buckle. It had a box that said, caution, baby rattlers. So I looked at it, and it was like literally like baby toys. And it was so funny. I loved this place.
I can see that.
But of course, we got fudge, and it was amazing. But yeah, there's a town. I can't remember what state, but it's one of those Midwest states.
Yeah, and probably because the way that Uranus is spelled looks more like your anus on a car than it would look like Uranus.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So.
Well, they just take all the fun out of everything, don't they?
They really do.
Good thing you can have your license plate. Your vanity plate.
At this point, I don't want to change it because mine's so easy to remember.
Yeah.
Even though it costs more. So easy. I can't imagine going back to like three letters and four numbers. I would never know what they were. I can't go back.
All right. What sad story are you telling me yet again, Mackenzie?
Wow. Way to just totally give away my whole story, Lauren.
I did nothing. You said it.
What did I? Buckle up. What?
You just said buckle up. But then I said, I have to tell you something.
Oh, okay. So I just said buckle up.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, buckle up, folks. The story of Paula and Robert Sims is a complicated one. From a true crime perspective, it's an interesting case. From a mental health perspective, it calls into question whether or not justice was served in the case of baby Heather Lee Sims. This story will contain topics such as postpartum mental disorders, infant deaths, and mentions of suicide. Our show notes will have resources available for those various topics should you want to learn more, or if you don't want to listen, you can look through some of those if you'd like.
Do you mention why you chose this one for Illinois anywhere?
I mean, I mentioned Forensic Files, so I figured that that would be implied.
Didn't you choose this one for a different state? Until you realized that it wasn't in that state and that it was in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's why you added Illinois to the list?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why we're covering this one.
Oh, yeah. That's what you mean. Yeah. There's, like, recent information. Like, I thought, like, the story in and of itself is already, like, whoa. And then the new information is also, like, whoa.
Ooh, okay.
So, yeah. I think it goes without saying that this is going to be sad.
Yeah.
So
I would expect nothing less from the trigger warnings you provided.
Yeah. Well, that's
and you're doing a better job warning us at the beginning of the episode than in the middle of the episode.
You know, I do my due diligence. So in the quiet town of Alton, Illinois, where our friendly giant lives or lived, on April 29th, the seemingly idyllic family, Robert and Paula Sims, were known for their reserved nature and dedication to their children. They crafted a life defined by simple pleasures and familial bonds. On that fateful night, Paula was unsuspectingly taking out the trash and found herself ambushed and rendered unconscious by the mysterious assailant. After working the night shift, Robert Sims returned home and found his wife unconscious on the kitchen floor.
She made it inside.
Yeah, he brought her inside. Ambushed her, rendered unconscious, but he brought her inside from outside.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then knocked her unconscious and on the kitchen floor.
Okay.
Their 2-year-old son, Randy, was asleep, undisturbed, in the upstairs bedroom. But the Sims discovered that their 6-week-old daughter, Heather, was missing. The police were immediately called. Investigators combed through the perplexing details of Heather's disappearance. The crib where Heather slept was undisturbed. Police didn't find any footprints or fingerprints that didn't belong in the home, and none of the valuables were missing. Neighbors recounted sightings of suspicious figures lurking near the Sims' home, adding to the intrigue surrounding the case. Another said they saw someone burying something behind a local factory.
Well.
Unfortunately, none of these leads proved helpful in finding baby Heather. Investigators even searched the section of the Mississippi River near the Sims house, yet despite exhaustive searches and leads that led nowhere, Heather remained elusive. The absence of clear motives or ransom demands only deepened the mystery. Captain Rick McCain of the Illinois State Police said, quote, "Seldom does anybody take a baby just for the sake of taking it."
Right.
There's usually a ransom demand, which we had none. Investigators asked the Sims if they had any enemies that would want to steal their child to get back at them in any way, and they said no.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't find any evidence of any extramarital problems, and there was no boyfriend that might suspect the child would have been his. They couldn't find anything that would explain why someone would target the Sims for kidnapping. Paula Sims was the only witness to a crime that baffles investigators to this day. 4 days later, Charles Saunders was fishing on the Missouri side of the Mississippi River. Around noon, when he was about to leave, he stopped to empty the trash into a barrel. Saunders noticed a large black garbage bag. Because of its size, it looked suspicious. Inside, he discovered the well-preserved remains of a dead baby girl.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Sergeant Tony Venamiga, a homicide investigator on the case, told forensic files that the baby looked like she could have been asleep instead of dead.
Oh.
Hand and footprints from the deceased baby were compared to the prints of Heather Sims. They were a match.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
I knew that's where we were going. Like, I knew we were going to get here. But I was just hoping that, like, my, like, thought was wrong. Sure. And that she would be found happy and safe.
Absolutely.
Ugh.
That's fair. I would hope that that was...
Right. Right.
Dr. Mary Case's meticulous autopsy revealed the chilling truth. Signs of suffocation in a body preserved in a freezer, casting a shadow of horror over the already grim narrative.
Oh, my God.
One of the first things she noticed was three small vertical cuts on the inside of the baby's upper lip. Dr. Case said, quote, obviously this is not, for an example, a sudden infant death, which is a natural death. It's not death by accident. It's not death by suicide. So it's a homicidal death.
Mm-hmm.
She continues, when I began the examination, there was no gunshot wound. There's no stab wound. There's no battering. And the inner lip showed signs that I associated with someone placing their hand over their nose and mouth and causing suffocation.
Oh.
So there were two factors that led Dr. Case to conclude that baby Heather had been placed in a freezer prior to being discovered in a trash barrel. The first had to do with lividity. Lividity is what happens after death occurs. The blood settles in parts of the body closest to the ground and is usually dark purple or red in color.
We learned about that when I took a class in college. We would see like a crime scene picture and our teacher would be like, okay, was this a murder, a suicide, or natural death? And so just based on the picture, we had to figure it out.
Wow.
And at the beginning, yeah, at the beginning, it was like every single one looked like a homicide because of the lividity or, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be like settled, so it would look like bruises. Mm-hmm. And then we learned eventually, like, nope. And then so by the end of the class, we were getting it.
Heck yeah. So Heather's face showed signs of lividity, but it was cherry red in color. This meant that the body had been placed in a freezer during the time lividity occurs, which is 8 to 12 hours after death.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Case added, quote, the external appearance was that there was no decomposition. When I looked internally, I even had to look microscopically, because the little baby, internal organs, to see. There was early decomposition, but it was a little bit more advanced than external. So she was saying that internally was further along in the decomposition stages than externally.
That makes sense, which, if you're in something.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Dr. Case concluded that Heather Sims had been suffocated, placed in a freezer face down, then placed in a trash bin face up either the night before or the morning after the body was discovered.
Mm.
At this point, there is no evidence connecting Paula or Robert Sims to the case. Assistant State's Attorney Dan Weber delved deeper into the Sims life story. During an interview with the FBI, Robert Sims made a peculiar remark. Weber recounted to forensic files, quote, he told the FBI that during the period when Heather was reported missing and subsequently found, they had experienced the longest lasting and best sex they ever had. This statement was incredibly startling to me. None of the other investigators involved in the investigation considered such a response to be normal after one's child had been kidnapped.
Wait, sorry, back up.
Yes.
What? So the parents said that?
The dad said that to the FBI agent that was... questioning him. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Doesn't get any better.
First off, that's just weird.
That's gross.
Like, why would you say that? Well, okay, no. First off, why would you even be having sex when your child's missing?
Well, he gives an answer to that at trial.
Oh, my God. Okay, well, we'll get to that. But here's my initial thoughts.
Okay.
Why? And then second off, why would you tell someone that?
Because he's a guy and he's probably talking to another guy.
God.
Probably felt the need to say it.
Men are... I'm sorry, men. Stupid.
So stupid.
I'm oh, God. Sorry. Okay.
You are dumb.
For real.
You know, don't like being called dumb, then...
Stop being dumb.
Check your fellow species, okay? In the thick of the unfolding tragedy, there was scrutiny turned toward Paula Sims, whose past held eerie parallels to Heather's fate. 3 years prior, a similar tragedy befell the Sims family, with an abduction and subsequent discovery of their first daughter, Lorelai.
What?
During the investigation, Paula Sims and her husband volunteered to take a lie detector test. Following the test in 1986, Robert Sims said, quote, it was a normal type of dealing with a crime of this fashion, and we passed it with flying colors that would absolutely clear any doubts in their minds of our character.
So their first daughter
uh-huh.
also died.
Was kidnapped and later found.
Dead.
Dead.
Okay. But I just wanted to make sure that something so absurd was the correct thing.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
But Jersey County authorities had different results. Jersey County, and this is still in Illinois, by the way.
Okay.
Just because it says Jersey County.
Yeah, I figured.
Jersey County Sheriff Frank Yocum said, quote, according to the polygraph examiner, all of those questions were answered by them, not truthfully. 10 days later, the skeletal remains of an infant were found about 150 feet behind the Sims home. Medical experts said that they were 97% sure it was Lorelai. The cause of death was never determined. Though suspicions lingered back then about the involvement of Paula and Robert Sims, the lack of conclusive evidence left authorities with a case that eventually turned cold. Yet, as investigators delved deeper, a disturbing pattern emerged, from inconsistencies in Paula's account to forensic analysis of evidence. The revelation of Paula's involvement in Heather's murder sent shockwaves through the community, shattering the illusion of the perfect family. Our pal Dan found something suspicious about Paula's head injury. Seeking further expertise, he consulted Dr. Case, who wasn't just a pathologist, but also a board-certified neuropathologist, an authority in the field of brain and nervous system studies.
So they're going to check her because she got hit in the head.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Dr. Case explained that when someone sustains a forceful blow causing unconsciousness, the brain's soft tissue collides with the skull's hard inner surface, resulting in brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
This collision disrupts the electrical activity in the brain's outer regions where memories are stored. Consequently, memory formation is hindered not only for the traumatic incident, but also for several minutes leading up to it.
Okay.
This phenomenon sheds light on why individuals who are knocked unconscious, such as in a car accident, recall very little about the event or its preceding moments.
Interesting.
So there were neurological inconsistencies in Paula's statement of being, quote, karate chopped in the back of the neck.
Mm-hmm.
And there were also, like, reports from, like, when she went to the hospital that she was fine.
Right.
Prompted by this, investigators decided to explore any potential connection between Paula Sims and the location where the body was found. Police discovered three-dimensional shoe impressions in the sole a short distance from the trash receptacle. These imprints, seemingly from an athletic shoe, did not match any footwear found in the Sims' residence. Subsequently, the law enforcement sent the black garbage bag containing Heather's remains to the FBI laboratory in Washington, D.C.
Whoop, whoop.
I tried to show my friends my lack of ability to say cooperated. And even once I finally got it right, they still tried to say it wasn't a word. I was like, who's a stupid one now? I was like, yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
I just can't say it.
Then maybe that's why it doesn't sound like a word.
But I like went really slow and I even used it in a sentence. And they're like, that's not a word. I'm like, yes, it is.
Listen to any true crime show. Anyone.
I was like, I swear. I was like, I just, Lauren, you say it. Ah, she's not here.
Just call me Lauren. Say the word I can't say. Cooperate?
Yeah, exactly. I actually, like, the first time I said it right, and they were
corroborated.
They were like, what? And I was like, yeah, corroborated. And they're like, what? I was like, see, I can't say it. And they're like, well, what are you trying to say? And I was like, corroborated. Corroborated. Like,
corroborated.
You corroborated someone's story. And they were like, you mean cooperate? I was like, no.
No, it has an emphasis somewhere else.
So, anyway, I don't think I say that in this. It just popped into my head, so I thought I'd share the thought out loud.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Forensic examiner David Attenberger faced limited evidence as no fingerprints, hairs, or fibers were detected on the bag. And this was also before.
DNA?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Like, right before.
Mm-hmm.
Agent Attenberger reported, quote, the bag in question was manufactured by Polytech Corporation based in Minneapolis, retailed by Kmart under the brand name Curbside. Over 1 million curbside garbage bags were produced for Kmart daily.
Wow.
Agent Attenberger attempted to compare the bag housing Heather with an unused garbage bag taken from the Sims kitchen. However, due to the stretching that naturally occurs when bags are pulled from the roll, aligning the ends proved unfeasible.
Ugh.
Nonetheless, the bag containing Heather exhibited a distinct characteristic. So according to information from forensic files, trash bags are crafted from large melted plastic sheets with a blade perforating them for easy separation from the roll, while a heat seal seals the bottom shut.
Oh, interesting.
The manufacturer informed investigators that debris accumulates on the hot seal as the plastic passes through it, which aids in identifying characteristics. Notably, incomplete melting on the heat seal caused a small hole at the bottom of the bag containing Heather. Moreover, debris on the heat seal led to a minor puncture in the bag. Analysis of the bags found in the Sims kitchen revealed the same puncture and hole caused by debris, confirming their connections, like, ooh, in the same exact places.
Yeah.
Further examination focused on dart lines with garbage bags during the manufacturing process. As plastic is pulled over rollers, it stretches, leaving visible marks known as dye lines. Comparison of the dye lines inside Heather Sims's bag with those of the first unused trash bag discovered in the Sims's kitchen yielded matching patterns. This led to the conclusion that the first unused bag was manufactured within a 10-second time frame of the bag used to contain Heather.
Oh.
Based on the garbage bag analysis and the inconsistency with her head injury story, Paula Sims was arrested for murder.
Damn.
Still got a lot. So take a stretch break. Move around.
Let me get a sip of water.
Buckle back in.
Everyone take a sip of water. It's important to stay hydrated.
I'll be like your little... A lot of people have the water bottle that reminds them, like, you got this. Keep going.
So the dynamics within the Sims marriage was also peculiar. When Paula brought their daughters home from the hospital, she found herself excluded from their bedroom.
Wait, sorry. What?
Okay. The dynamics within the Sims marriage were peculiar. According to author and journalist Charles Bosworth, when Paula brought their daughters home from the hospital, she found herself excluded from their bedroom.
Each night, like each time she brought them home?
Yeah. First with Lorelai.
Okay, okay.
Initially, she and Lorelai slept in the basement where the family room was located. It wasn't until after Lorelai's passing that Paula resumed sleeping upstairs with her husband.
Hmm.
So the lady who just gave birth was sleeping on the couch.
Yeah.
A year following Lorelai's demise, Paula gave birth to their son, Randy. Upon relocating to Alton, Illinois, Paula welcomed another baby girl. Allegedly, during her hospital stay, Paula confided to her roommate her aversion to having another daughter, expressing the same preference as Robert for sons. Evidence indicated a clear favoritism towards boys over girls.
Oh my God.
Witnesses attested to Robert's adoration for his son, showing little interest in his daughters even during their births at the hospital.
I'm sorry. If you're going to be like this, don't have kids. You do not deserve to have kids.
A decade before Lorelai was killed, Sims told a coworker that she did not want children, quote, especially not a little girl. It's too much trouble.
Oh my gosh.
After Lorelai was born, Sims's roommate in the hospital heard her crying and apologizing while talking on the phone to her husband for having a baby girl.
Jesus. And women, just so you know, it's the man. The man's DNA is what determines the child. Just want to throw that out there.
That means that they would have to have some sort of idea about reproduction, mm-hmm. and they don't.
That's why when, like, all of those, like, old-timey things where it's like, you can't bore me a man. It's like, no, you can't bore you a man.
Yeah.
You're the reason there are no men.
Exactly, but they definitely didn't know back then.
No. No, of course not.
Robert Sims admitted his wife had apologized for having a girl, but Paula denied making such an apology. Investigators said it was very obvious that they had a baby boy, but there were no pictures or anything to indicate that they had or ever had a baby girl.
What the heck?
Upon bringing Heather home, separate sleeping arrangements resumed. Paula and Heather slept in the living room while Robert and Randy occupied the upstairs. A remark made by Paula to a friend hinted at her dissatisfaction with these arrangements, suggesting that there would need to be a change or she might take action. Here's what prosecutors say is what happened on that night.
Okay.
So, on the night of April 29th, 1989, while Robert was working the night shift at the paper plant, prosecutors believed that Paula suffocated her daughter, Heather. She placed her body in a garbage bag from the kitchen. She probably wore gloves since no prints were found on the bag. After the murder, Paula drove across town to her parents' home, where she placed Heather's body in her parents' freezer. Mm. Paula's parents had been away that week on vacation. Paula returned home with enough time to feign unconsciousness before her husband returned from work. The next day, when Paula's parents heard about the kidnapping, they decided to end their vacation early and return home immediately. This meant that Paula needed to change her plans. Paula now had to go back to her parents' home and remove Heather's body before they returned. Prosecutors believe she brought Heather's body back home and placed it in her own freezer. And by now, the police had concluded their search of the Sims' home, so she wasn't worried that they were going to find it.
Mm-hmm.
A few days later, Paula needed to get rid of the body. She made the 2-mile drive across the Mississippi River, across the Lewis and Clark Bridge, into a parking area. And she left the frozen body in the trash bin that was later found by the fishermen. So I'm not going to go through all the details of her trial because we still got more stuff coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to give you some, like, tidbits so you're kind of in the know of the gist.
Okay.
So her defense attorney, Donald Groshong, represented both Paula and Robert because he was also definitely under suspicion, but they didn't have any evidence to officially tie him to it.
What was their evidence to tie her?
The bag and the head injury and the previous baby. because the exact same thing happened.
Yeah. But I don't know. I feel like if they have that to tie her, they should have that to tie him because the bag's like their house bag.
Home.
Oh, okay.
So the physical evidence more goes to her than to him. Yeah. But it was like the exact same thing. He was working, comes home, baby stolen.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing happened.
Right.
Well, you'll see in a moment. He later told the press that Robert was supportive of Paula throughout the entire process. A grand jury indicted Paula on first-degree murder, obstructing justice, and concealing a homicide. Groshong discussed an insanity plea with Paula, but it contradicted her claim of innocence.
Mm.
Paula had no history of depression. Without documentation of postpartum depression, innocence was a better defense.
Mm-hmm.
She insisted she was telling the truth during her trial, and Groshong claims he believed her. Paula maintained her innocence to the courts as she recounted the abductions of Lorelei and Heather at her trial. When Paula Sims testified at her trial, she broke the news that the intruder of April 1989 was the same person who had broken into her home in 1986.
Okay.
She knew that the assailant was the same person by his voice. She also stated that he was definitely a white male. On the stand during her trial, Robert, who backed his wife's story, was asked about his comment to the FBI about having great sex with his wife while Heather was missing.
Right.
Robert Sims replied, quote, "Let me tell you something. Sex can be a stress reliever."
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I hate them.
On February 2nd, 1990, after deliberating for 2 days, jurors found Paula guilty of 2 counts of first-degree murder, 2 counts of obstructing justice, and 1 count of concealing a homicide.
So are they trying to get her for Lorelei stuff, too?
Which they did.
Wow.
Paula Sims was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. No charges were ever filed against Robert, who denied having anything to do with the crimes, but investigators were still suspicious of him. However, investigators still don't have any doubts that the right person's in jail.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they have their suspicions of him,
they know that someone is.
Yeah. So since the conviction, got a couple things going on.
Okay.
So a couple years after her conviction, Paula did finally admit to killing her two daughters without the help of Robert.
Wow.
On August 28th, 1994, Paula filed a pro se post-conviction petition alleging Groshong provided ineffective assistance of counsel by dismissing the use of the insanity defense. Paula claimed that Groshong was only dedicated to her ex-husband's defense. She said she suffered from major depression and guilt because her husband did not want Heather and blamed her for having the child. After she announced the murders were the result of postpartum psychosis, she accused Groshong of ignoring the postpartum psychosis insanity defense and requested a new trial to determine if postpartum disorders diminished her capacity to understand the criminality of her conduct. An expert on postpartum disorders, Dr. Diane Sanford, claims Paula suffered from a postpartum-based mental illness when she killed Heather.
Ugh.
Paula admitted her guilt and continued to take responsibility for acting alone, but Paula believed contributing marital pressures mitigated her guilt, and that Groshong's loyalty to her husband kept him from pursuing the judge for leniency. Although, originally, they wanted to give her the death penalty, and she got life, so I think that's pretty lenient.
I would say so.
Groshong explained if he had argued that Robert's behavior drove Paula to infanticide, it would contradict her own claims of innocence.
Mm-hmm.
It was ruled that Groshong's representation did not constitute a conflict, and on September 7th, 1994, the trial court dismissed her pro se petition. Before we kind of continue, some background information on postpartum depression, if you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Because of hormonal changes that occur after childbirth, mothers frequently experience negative physical and emotional effects after delivery. Most women who suffer these effects only experience what is known unofficially as the baby blues.
Mm.
In some cases, the mother will suffer from a more serious disorder termed postpartum depression. Statistics show that baby blues affect 80% of women after childbirth.
Wow.
Which is terrifying. About 20% of those women who go on to be diagnosed or suffer without a diagnosis with postpartum depression. So 20% of that 80%
right.
move into the next category. Even more rare is postpartum psychosis, which affects between 1% and 3% of the women with postpartum depression.
Mm-hmm.
So
3% of the 20% of the 80%.
Correct. You got it.
Thank you.
As the name implies, postpartum psychosis results in women suffering a break from reality and often becoming delusional. Tragically, postpartum psychosis has a 5% suicide rate and a 4% infanticide rate.
Wow.
Some experts believe that some sudden infant death syndrome deaths, are actually homicides as a result of extreme postpartum depression or postpartum psychosis.
Jeez.
So in 2006, Sim participated in one interview with Kay Quinn. Sims had been incarcerated at Dwight Correctional Center in Northern Illinois for 16 years at this point. Her interview had several conditions: that she not be asked about her ex-husband and her son, that the questions center around the topic of postpartum depression, and that she would not have to talk about what happened the night her infant daughters died. At the time, Sims was asking Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich to grant her clemency and let her out of prison because she was mentally ill at the time she murdered her daughters. Paula Sims said it was postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis that led her to murder her daughters. Sims said, quote, "I just want to bring awareness and let people know this is real and I'm not some monster. I can't change that if someone thinks I'm a monster. I know I'm not. I know I'm a good person, and I know I'm being punished for being mentally ill." It was in prison that Paula Sims says she heard about postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis. After talking with mental health professionals, she now believes the disease drove her to kill. Quote, "I'm not trying to make no excuses here," said Sims. See, I was on a roll too. Then
you call. You were not.
I was on a roll with this part. I didn't say the whole thing, just right here. A lot of women have been through worse than what I've been through, and they don't do something like this. So I'm a weak woman. What can I say? Sims says she started hearing voices right after Lorelai was born on June 5th, 1986.
Oh.
Lorelai was killed 13 days later. Sims said the symptoms were similar but more intense after Heather was born. Quote, "I was so weak," said Sims. "I hadn't eaten in probably 2 weeks. Not only had it got me emotionally, it had got me physically, and I kept fighting and fighting the voices. I talked to the voices just like I talk to you right now. I paced around the house, drinking alcohol, smoking marijuana, smoking a cigarette, and telling them to leave me alone. I wasn't going to do it. I didn't want to do it. Just leave me alone." She says she tried to tell those closest to her, but for various reasons wasn't able to. Quote, "I didn't tell them the thoughts I was having with Heather because the voices told me then, what about Lorelai? You're getting ready to expose yourself. I had that dark secret that I planned on taking to my grave." She said in the weeks and months leading to her trial in 1990, she and her attorney, Don Groshong, never discussed postpartum depression or postpartum psychosis as a possible defense. Quote, "My attorney said all I needed to do was keep my mouth shut. He was going to get me out of this mess," said Sims. "It didn't matter to him whether I was innocent or guilty. So that's what I did and tried to deal with what was going on inside of me."
Let me go fill up my water and get a cough drop.
Good God, woman.
I was fine. And all of a sudden, I don't know what.
And then it's one of those things, the more I focus on not coughing, the more it's like, I'm here.
Yeah, like when you're getting your nails done, all of a sudden your entire body itches.
That doesn't happen as much.
Lauren! Sims said in appeal, Groshong said the defense team had considered and researched postpartum depression as a motive during the trial. Hadn't. Hadn't.
Repeat.
Okay. Sims said in appeal, Groshong said the defense team hadn't considered and researched postpartum depression as a motive during the trial. Sim was asked if the reason Groshong didn't discuss postpartum is because she insisted she was innocent. Quote, "He never asked me. He never had a psychologist or a psychiatrist evaluate me, so I'll never know if what I would have been asked, what would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
I believed my hallucinations. I heard voices telling me to do this. I argued with the voices with Lorelai. It really happened quick. But with Heather, I fought and fought for 6 weeks, and I thought we were going to make it. I just knew we were going to make it. Obviously, we didn't." A psychologist testified at Sims' post-conviction hearing that Sims fit the mold of a postpartum baby killer, down to delusions that a stranger committed the crime. The shrink gave 2 psychological tests to Sims in 1992, asking her to answer as though it were still 1989.
Okay, like go back a couple years and answer these questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Quote, "She perceived herself as hearing voices, people getting into her head," the psychologist told the court. The judge asked whether lying is common with women suffering from this disorder. Quote, "Very often, because they have disordered thinking, they make up stories about other people coming in and taking the children, harming the children," the doctor testified. Edward Lau, a psychologist at the Dwight Correctional Center where Sims is held, said she told him of hearing voices and claimed to have tried to kill herself with alcohol and pills before her arrest in 1989. Lau said Sims told him she felt violence towards Randy, too, and once nearly attacked the child.
How, what's the age difference between Randy and Heather?
A year and a half.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Quote, "She realized her anger was going to overcome her, but she left the room," he said. An emotionless Sims testified for almost 90 minutes about her girls' deaths. Quote, "I didn't know what was wrong with me," she said. "It's not a natural thing for a mother to do that." Jean Peterson, another psychologist at the prison where Sims is in prison, testified that she was suffering, quote, major depression when she arrived there and might not have realized it. Three courts, however, found Sims' arguments unpersuasive. So in the post-conviction hearing, the trial attorney, so what's his name? Tired of saying his name, it sounds weird. I don't think I'm saying it right. Addressed his decision not to employ an insanity defense as follows. He studied a public defender's materials and suggestions and had an associate conduct independent research into the use of postpartum depression insanity defenses and discussed the possibility of an insanity plea with Paula before electing to discard it. An insanity plea would have detracted from Paula's claim of innocence. Moreover, Paula had never complained of depression-like symptoms, and an examination of her medical records proved consistent with this lack of complaint. Given the absence of testimony to support a postpartum depression defense, the better defense was Paula's claimed innocence, a claim made stronger by avoiding inconsistency. But again, it had been dismissed.
Right.
In 2015, Robert Sims, now 63, and Randall Sims, Randy, now 27, died at the scene of a car crash in Jackson, Mississippi.
Oh, no.
The two men were headed to Pass Christian, where they planned to do missionary work, authorities said. Yolanda McNeely is accused of hitting the Jeep, which caused it to crash off the overpass. McNeely drove on and crashed at the next exit, police said. She is charged with two counts of aggravated DUI death and one felony charge of leaving the scene of an accident.
Oh.
Isn't that crazy?
Yes.
I did not expect that.
This poor family.
I was like reading something else, which is also going to be like, what? And I had to then go back and find what happened.
Like, just picture a grandma.
Yeah.
Who's lost so many people.
Correct. So the insurance company had asked a judge to decide who should inherit the $50,000 death benefit of Sims's son and ex-husband. Kevin Babb, who represents the insurance company, said, quote, "This is a very recognized method by which insurance companies ask the court who the appropriate beneficiary should be. The decision by the judge would clarify how the death benefit money would be divided. Robert Sims had remarried, and his wife would have been the sole heir to their estate, and Paula Sims would have been their son's heir. But Babb said the decision isn't that simple. He said if hypothetically Robert Sims had died before his son, some or all of the money would have been left to his son. And when his son died, his share would then go to his mom."
Oh, my gosh.
So how much, if any, should go to Paula Sims? Paula Sims sent a handwritten statement to the court dated November 19, turning over any assets for which she would be eligible to Victoria Sims. Sims, who was 56 at the time, wrote from the Logan Correctional Center in Lincoln that she is turning over the auto insurance proceeds to Victoria Sims, the widow of her former husband, Robert Sims. Paula Sims also gave Victoria Sims any savings or checking account in the name of Randy and gave her the right to sue on behalf of Randy for any wrongful death suit.
Wow.
So she pretty much turned over everything.
Which, good, because I don't think she should have gotten anything.
And she, from what it sounded like, I don't think she argued. Like, yeah. Once she saw that she had this request, she was like, okay, here. You know, she didn't, you know, hesitate.
Yeah.
In 2001, so a couple years ago, Governor J.B. Pritzker commuted Sims's sentence from life in prison without parole to life in prison with the possibility of parole.
Oh.
The review board voted 12-1 to grant it.
Wow.
The reasons the review board decided to release Sims from prison were based on arguments by the board member in charge of researching her case, her attorney, and two psychologists at an October 28th hearing in Springfield. They argued that Sims committed the crimes due to postpartum psychosis, a rare mental illness that causes some new mothers to experience delusions, hallucinations, and paranoia. The experts didn't fully understand it 3 decades ago, and that a new Illinois law allows it to be a mitigating factor in sentencing.
Oh.
While Keegan attorney Jed Stone represented Sims at the review board hearing with input from psychologists Susan Feingold and Diane Sanford, which was at her first one.
Okay.
Who had diagnosed and treated Sims. Board member Donald Shelton made a presentation on Sims' behalf, describing his extensive research on postpartum psychosis and experiencing his belief that she wasn't an evil person. Quote, "I trust the judgment of the psychologists," he said. Shelton said Sims had an outstanding prison record, receiving only 2 tickets for nonviolent incidents and earning a long list of educational certificates. She mentored other inmates and co-authored state legislation related to postpartum illnesses.
Wow.
Review board chairman Craig Finley spoke in support of Sims at the hearing. He had visited her years ago while doing research for another case in which a mother had killed a child. Quote, I found Paula Sims to be very gentle and kind soul. Someone who said, I accept my fate. I understand that I will spend the rest of my life in prison, Finley said. So as of today, Paula Sims is a free woman.
She was released?
Yeah, that's what I mean by she got paroled.
Oh!
Yeah.
I thought just like she had like the eligibility to get it.
Yeah, she had the eligibility to get paroled and then the review board voted 12-1 to grant it.
Oh, see, I thought when you said grant it, like they granted that, okay, she can have the possibility of parole.
Oh, no, no, no.
Oh. Yeah,
the governor did that.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry, that wasn't clear. Yeah.
Damn.
Yes. So the reasons.
That's why there wasn't that big of a reaction earlier.
Okay.
I was like, okay, now she has a possibility. Like, okay.
So the reasons I just mentioned are why she got paroled.
Okay.
Yeah.
Damn.
So there's mixed. I found a change.org petition for her to get her released. There was a post on Reddit that was in support of her. Pretty much the people who believe that she did suffer from postpartum depression and psychosis believe she shouldn't be punished for it, which I agree with.
Or she should be in a mental facility.
Either one.
Because there are those people who have like schizophrenia or something. And when they kill someone, they still go somewhere.
Because that's still a factor. I think hers.
Oh, because it's. Okay. Yeah.
And so I agree that she shouldn't be punished for something if she was experiencing that at the time. However, I don't know if I fully believe her, just given the timing of everything.
Right. How it there was so much planning going into it.
Right.
You know?
It's
like, it doesn't sound like a psychosis moment where.
It sounds possible when you think of like the relationship she had with her husband and like how that can impact you.
Yeah.
But, and maybe it's because she didn't know about it until later on. Like she said, she didn't learn about this until she was already in prison.
Right.
And at no point was she trying to make excuses. She completely accepts responsibility. She's like, yes, this is something I did. My daughters are the true victims. Like there's remorse. There's all the things that you would be looking for. So let's say it wasn't that, if we're thinking of rehabilitation, then I feel like she's still also saying the right things. It's hard because in a situation like this, it comes down to, I don't want to say that a woman is not telling the truth about that.
Right.
And I know that this is a topic that's not really talked about as much as other mental health disorders.
No, not at all.
And a lot of Republican senators were all up in arms about it. And there was the part of me that I was like, okay, if you're thinking just specifically about her and you don't believe that this is what she suffered from, then I can understand your anger. But I'm looking at it that the people that okayed it do believe her. And they are right. She shouldn't be punished for that. In the way that she was,
right.
Maybe it was going to a mental health facility. Obviously, that time has passed. And so based on that, taking out who it was against, then yes, that part I agree with. Whether or not it should be accepted for her, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, like that's, it's one of those things where you can connect some dots, you can unconnect some dots.
Yeah.
She maintained what's his name's.
Her husband.
Yeah, in a sense. I know it's a TV show, but I feel like battered woman syndrome is handled very similarly to like postpartum depression and psychosis in terms of taking seriously by courts and things like that.
Why are you saying a TV show?
Because there was an episode of Criminal Minds.
Oh, okay.
where the prosecutor had two of the profiles come in and look at this woman to determine, like, did she kill her husband? And she did, but they were like, she has battered woman syndrome, but it was not necessarily physical abuse. It was psychological, emotional abuse. So that's why I guess it was, like, tricky. And so when I think of cases like this where it's especially because it's a mental health disorder that's not talked about.
Yeah.
And at least, you know, they say, yes, it was talked about back then, depending on who you ask.
It's not even really talked about now.
Exactly.
So no.
So it's like I'm being pulled two ways because I agree with what she's saying, but I don't know if I agree with it for her. I don't know if I believe her when she's saying that this is the state of mind she specifically was in.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know which way to...
I don't know. I just think it was very planned for psychosis.
Yeah. I think it's a good point that, like, her...
And also, too, like, I get it was, like, the whole daughter thing, but you had two daughters and you did have one son. You never did anything to the son.
Well, that's the point. That's part of what the... What added to the psychosis was because her husband didn't want daughters. When she had a daughter, this is how she was treated by him.
Okay, okay.
And... But the son, perfectly fine.
Yeah.
And so, because of all that, and apparently if she didn't know what this was until later on.
Yeah.
And was like, oh, wait a minute. You know, you read something, you're like, hey, that happened to me. Then maybe it clicked. Like, it's not far-fetched, but it's like there's nothing solid for me to be like, oh, yeah, you are definitely telling the truth.
Yeah.
Which I feel terrible about because, I women supporting women, I want to believe their stories.
Yeah.
But it's hard in situations like this.
Mm-hmm.
And especially because a baby still died.
Right.
And so where we need to make sure that's still being held accountable, you know, and that, I don't know, all the things that she was saying and part of that interview about, like, loving her daughters and, you know, still loving them, that part was where I was like, well, but people have heard you say that you don't want them.
Right. Right. Like, no.
You know, so like, again, it's like, I don't know. It's hard. Well, it's not up to us because she's free anyway. While the story is heartbreaking, it's good to bring awareness to topics like this that are new to our justice system and figuring out the best way to handle them and also providing more support for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's, I know, like, I'll see women on Twitter too, who say that for a while they were embarrassed to talk about these things because they didn't know if anyone else went through them.
Right.
And so having more people talk about these things give people a sense of community.
Yeah.
And maybe you'll feel better.
Maybe.
So like we said, there's resources in our show notes where you can learn more about the postpartum disorder or ways to support or find support for yourself. So our hearts always go out to all the mamas out there, whatever kind of mom you are. And remember, take care of yourself, and you are worth it. And yeah, that's the story of little baby Heather Lee Sims.
Well, nice telling.
Thank you.
Sad case. But nice telling. Nice bringing awareness, as we like to do.
Yeah. I knew that I was going to use the Forensic Files episode, but then I started looking at articles just to get extra information, and then it popped up that she was paroled, and I was like, what?
Yeah.
What did I miss? So I had to do some digging.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah.
Well, nicely done.
Thank you.
Nicely done.
I'm almost done with all my Forensic Files episodes.
Oh, my goodness. Whatever are you going to do?
I don't know. I don't know where I'm going to find my ideas.
You have to do what I do. Weird things in state. Mysteries in state.
I do weird mysteries, creepy places, urban legends, unsolved.
Yep.
True crime.
Yep. Like, pretty much what I search too.
Fit all the categories in.
Everything our show covers.
Exactly. What spooky tea you pouring, Lauren?
Okay, so today I have one that it's not... You'll see. Okay.
That was... Thank you.
It's not sad.
It cleared up...
It's not sad.
Everything that I could possibly know about this case.
I know. Thank you. Okay. In the mid-1940s, the people of Mattoon, Illinois were being terrorized by something that they couldn't see. Mattoon is a small town and as of 2020 had a population of only 16,870 people. Also, fun fact, it is allegedly the bagel capital of the country.
Bullshit.
Allegedly.
Bullshit.
So in Mattoon, over the span of 2 weeks, the police received more than 24 calls about separate incidents of and strange sightings of a mysterious mad gasser who was attacking families in a series of gas attacks.
Mad gasser. That sounds like the name of an episode of a children's cartoon.
Yes.
The mad gasser.
Has to go to the bathroom.
The mad gas.
Yeah. So the reports always follow the same pattern. The victims would first smell a sweet, strange odor in their homes, one they weren't familiar with. The smell would quickly be followed by symptoms of paralysis of the legs, coughing, nausea, and vomiting. Thankfully, no one died from the attacks or even had any serious medical consequences as a result of the attacks.
Wait a minute. I don't like the name.
Well, that's the name that they have.
Because I was thinking it was going to be stinky and it's sweet smelling.
Oh.
We need a better name. I'll think of one.
The sweet gasser. The gracious gasser.
There you go.
Yeah.
Perfect.
The first attack of the Mad Gasser took place on August 31st, 1944, at a home on Grant Avenue. Urban Rayef, his name is Urban, woke up in the early morning hours.
It was probably before Urban meant city.
Yeah.
Or legend. Or the clothing store.
So, he woke up early in the morning hours to a strange smell. Upon waking, he felt nauseated and weak. He then started vomiting. Rayef at first thought that he was suffering from gas poisoning, like the gas line in his house was the cause. So he woke up his wife, who decided to head to the kitchen stove to see if there was a problem with the pilot light.
I thought that gas doesn't smell.
Gas smells? That's why they make it smell.
No, I know, like, if you have, like, your stove on, like, I know that
Yeah.
one. But it, what a, like, even if when it's, like, the, like, a main gas thing,
mm-hmm.
what's the one that doesn't smell?
Carbon monoxide.
Oh, okay.
No, they purposely made gas so that it smells, so that if there's a leak, you know.
Oh.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah.
They yeah. should do that with carbon monoxide.
They should. So she went to go see if the pilot light was the problem. As she tried to get out of the bed, though, she realized she couldn't move. She was paralyzed and unable to leave her bed. The Rayef said their paralysis lasted about 90 minutes.
Oh, my God.
I know. Just a few hours later, another attack was reported, this time by Miss Violet Driscoll, a young mother who lived close to the Rayefs. She said that she and her daughter, Romano, awoke late that night to hear someone removing the storm sash of their bedroom window.
What's that?
I think the screen, or like part of the screen part. This was in the 1940s, so different words.
Yeah.
They both tried to jump up from the bed to run and get help, but the fumes overcame Romana and she began vomiting.
This is definitely the beginning of a Criminal Minds episode for sure.
Oh, probably.
I can think of like five that this works for.
Her mother stated that she saw a man running from the house. Violet was overcome by the gas as well, and when she tried to get up, she found she was unable to move. That following day, September 1st.
I have like the sudden urge to Google gases that like make you paralyzed and smell sweet.
Oh, I'll get to things.
Oh, I know you will. But like right now, I'm right like, I want to have the answer.
Yeah, no spoiler alerts. So that following day, September 1st, a third attack was reported. Aileen Kearney of 1408 Marshall Avenue was at home and had just put her two children to bed. Her husband, Bert, worked as a taxi driver and was out working that night, so Aileen's sister, Martha, and her nephew were staying the night. Around 11 p.m., while in her bedroom, Aileen noticed a sweet but strong odor. At first, she dismissed it, thinking it was just the flowers that sat outside her window.
That would be some strong smelling flowers.
But sometimes, you know, when you walk outside and you smell flowers, you're like, ooh, that's the smell of pollen right there.
Well, I figured because collectively outside, there's a bunch of them, but just the bit wafting into my...
And some pretty poor windows, too, if this odor's getting through.
But well, they have it open.
They don't.
Oh, yeah. No, then that's not good.
But soon the odor got strong and Aileen began to lose feeling of her legs. She panicked and let out a scream, which got the attention of her sister, Martha.
Has it only been like just their legs are paralyzed? Like
so far, yeah.
Okay.
Martha rushed into the room upon hearing her sister yell and also noticed the smell. She immediately opened the window, clearing out the mysterious scent.
Mm.
Obviously, the police were contacted, but there was no evidence of any sort of prowler at the house. They searched all
around. Well, she opened the window and let it go.
Do you think it's an invisible prowler?
Well, you said it's something you can't see.
Oh, God. They searched all around, found nothing, and eventually left. Bert arrived home after his shift around 12:30 a.m., When he arrived home, he saw a tall man hiding close to one of the house's windows, like crouched under the window. The man fled and Bert gave chase, but the man got away. The police were called again, and Bert was able to give a description of the man. He said that the prowler was a tall, thin man. He was dressed in dark clothing, wearing a tight-fitting cap, so think like a skull cap.
What cap?
Like a skull cap. It's just like a really tight cap on your head.
Like a swim cap?
No.
What's a skull cap?
Like a skull cap. Like think like Under Armour runners will wear it, like workout people. These.
That's a swim cap.
Skull cap.
Well,
that's not a swim cap. Yes, it's different.
It
it's different fabric. It's not a swim
cap. It looks exactly like a swim cap.
Oh, but for some people, it's a religious thing. Apparently.
So it's a tight cap.
You have a very tight cap.
Got
yes.
it.
Yeah.
Like something you might use for like a wig.
Not swimming. Oh, no, that's not. No.
I'm just thinking of all the tight caps.
Not that tight.
Yeah, who would wear that for just, like, fashion?
Oh, someone in the 40s. So the paralysis in Aileen's legs lasted about 30 minutes, but following the attack, she said that she suffered from a burning sensation on her lips and in her throat, which were attributed to the effects of gas. Though this was technically the third attack, the media incorrectly reported it as the first one. The headline, quote, "Miss Kearney and daughter first victims," was spread everywhere by the Mattoon Journal-Gazette. This sent the town into a frenzy. So the police tried to figure out what the motive for this believed first act was, and they decided that it was probably an attempt at a robbery, because just that day, Miss Kearney had withdrawn a large amount of money from the bank, brought it home, and proceeded to count the money at her kitchen table with her sister that evening.
Or it's someone who's, like, practicing for a robbery, like, trying to see how long the gas renders them incapacitated.
Oh, potentially. But so to go on with this robbery theory, the windows looking into the kitchen had been open that night, and Miss Kearney and Martha had been in plain view of anyone wishing to look in. So they're just like kind of right there counting all this.
Close your blinds, people.
I read this one story that someone had posted about, and they're like, yeah, when my grandma was younger, she used to put all of her stuff right outside of her bedroom window or bedroom door so that if anyone did try to rob her, she could just say, take everything there. That's all I have. I was like, times were different. After the Kearneys reported their incident and the news released the story about it, half a dozen similar incidents were reported. Olive Brown claimed she had been attacked months earlier with similar symptoms. George Ryder's wife said she was attacked the same night as the Kearneys. She said she had been up drinking, quote, several pots of coffee when she heard a plop. She then started to smell something off that made her hands and legs tingle, followed by her feeling dizzy like she was floating. Another family consisting of Miss Russell Bailey, Catherine Tuzo, Miss Genevieve Haskell, and Miss Haskell's young son were sleeping when the gasser sprayed fumes into their partially open window. Miss Frances Smith, the principal of the Columbian Grade School, and her sister Maxine were sprayed with the gas and became ill. They were woken by a choking feeling. They then felt the familiar partial paralysis in their legs and arms. They reported that the sweet odor filled their room, quote, as a thin blue vapor. Then they heard a buzzing noise from outside, leading them to believe that the noise was the gasser's spraying apparatus in operation.
Is she the only one to say, a color that she's seen?
Yep, they're the only two to see, like, some color.
Okay.
Though there were many victims, none were able to provide a description of the prowler, and no clues or evidence were ever found at any of the crime scenes.
And no one took their blood.
Well, this was the 1940s.
I know.
So, no.
Well, not to analyze it for DNA, but they knew how to analyze blood at that point for other things.
Oh, yeah. No blood tests.
Dom, Daniel.
Finally, on September 5th, some physical evidence was found. Carl and Beulah Cords were living...
Say it again?
Carl and Beulah Cords.
Say it again.
No. We're living at North 21st Street, returned home at 10 p.m. As they were settling into being back home, they noticed that out on their porch, next to the screen door, was a piece of white cloth, slightly larger than a man's handkerchief.
Like hanging in the door?
Like just...
Like it was stuck or...
No, like on their porch, but like the part next to the door.
Oh, okay. Okay.
For some reason, Beulah picked it up and smelled it.
Well, that was silly.
As soon as she did this stupid thing, she said she felt a jolt similar to an electric shock, then became violently ill.
Is it like the first person to use chloroform? Picks up the cloth?
No. That's what I thought too when I first read this, but no.
Damn it.
So she became violently ill, her face began to swell, and she experienced a burning sensation in her mouth and throat. She then began to vomit. She reported feeling weak and experienced paralysis in her legs.
It's interesting to me that the vomit happens, because normally you think of that, like, if someone ingests something.
Yes, exactly.
That their body responds by trying to throw it up.
Yep.
But if they're inhaling it.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It is interesting. Well, like, I mean, you can smoke so much nicotine that you throw up.
That's true. I guess if it, like, makes you dizzy enough or it can make you nauseous enough to get sick.
Yeah. Yeah. So later, Beulah said that she believed the cloth had been left outside in order to incapacitate their family dog, who usually slept right on the porch.
He is planning.
In order for whoever to gain access to the house could access it without a dog being in the way.
Genius.
We're not rooting for this person.
No, we're not. I'm just appreciating good planning.
Okay. Better planning than some other people.
Yeah.
So in addition to the cloth, on the sidewalk adjacent to the porch was a skeleton key, which looked well used, and a large, almost empty tube of lipstick.
Skeleton keys are just like a concept that I don't understand.
They just have access to everything.
I know, that doesn't make sense. That doesn't, how can one key have access to everything, but my key can't open your door?
Right.
Like it just, nope.
Yeah.
No matter how someone tries to explain it, it's like Phoebe with dinosaurs. How do you know?
I love it. So police took the cloth and had it analyzed, but they found no chemicals that could explain Beulah's reaction to the cloth. The same night as the Cords experience, September 5th, yet another incident was reported on North 13th Street. Miss Leonard Burnell reported seeing a stranger breaking in through her bedroom window and attempting to gas her. So he didn't get there, but he tried. A local fortune teller, Edna James, also smelled a strange smell in the boarding house that she ran that night. When she went to investigate, she said she encountered, quote, an ape-like man with large arms reaching out holding a spray gun. The man doused her with three clouds of gas that caused her arms and legs to go numb. So at this point, obviously, the public is freaking out.
Yeah.
News articles are going wild, posting articles of the attacks, calling this mystery person the Mad Gasser, the Gas Fiend, and the Mad Phantom.
The Gas Fiend.
The article spoke of the experiences of the victims with sensationalized titles like Anesthetic Prowler on the Loose and Mad Anesthesist. Nope. I knew I wouldn't be able to say this one. Or Mad Anesthetist Strikes Again. That's what the internet told me to pronounce it. So
I think because that's like the person who's like
anesthesia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Soldiers who were fighting on the front lines of World War II were riding home, asking if their family back in Mattoon was safe. More worried about what was going on back home than where they were.
I think there's more important priorities, but go ahead.
A man named James Arend read about the Mad Gasser from an army base all the way in England.
Yeah, so there's definitely more concerns because you're getting bombed.
So this was spreading all over the country.
That's crazy.
All over
though.
The world.
I am like imagining you're across the country. Across the world. There's bombs going off around you. And these men are getting these letters.
A Mad Gasser.
A Mad Gasser.
I must write home.
Oh my God. Sir, you have to let me go home.
There's a Mad Gasser on the loose.
One farts in their face. Said, I'll show you a Mad Gasser, because they're all men. That'd be really stupid.
Honestly, that probably happened. So one of the scariest parts is that there was no description of this person other than from Mr. Kearney, who said that it was just a tall, thin man. So it was unknown if this was a single person committing all of these attacks, or if maybe it was a whole group.
A bunch of kids stacked up on each other under a trench coat.
The public and the police had literally no idea. So for months, U.S. newspapers were warning readers that the Nazis might employ poison gas and attacks against civilians.
Oh, sweet Jesus.
So this just added to the frenzy and the fear.
Oh, my God.
The public reaction was so bad that the FBI had to get involved. They even had to employ the help of other police departments to handle the town. The army was involved and decided to bring in chemical weapon experts. Their hypothesis was that the gas might have been chloropicrin, a poisonous gas that has a sweet odor usually used for exterminating rodents.
Ooh.
You need some chloropicrin. It'll have a sweet smell and kill the rodents.
I'd rather just not have rodents.
But now you have chloropicrin. So no traces of this chemical were found, and the effects didn't match those that had been reported. Armed vigilante groups started forming who would patrol the streets at night on a hunt for this Mad Gasser. One person was actually arrested by the group but was released after they passed a polygraph.
If I was a Mad Gasser, just gas them. Because then they'd fall, and what are they going to do? Oh, they can't come get you. They can't move.
Right, they're on the ground. Haha. Mm-hmm. The local police had to issue a statement calling on residents to avoid lingering in residential areas and to warn that groups set up in the area to patrol for the gasser should be disbanded for reasons of public safety. And because we live in America, Chief of Police C.E. Cole had to warn concerned citizens that they needed to exercise due restraint when carrying or discharging firearms.
Wow, and this was all the way back in the 1940s.
Yep.
Weird.
Women started carrying bats and clubs with them whenever they left the house, and residents began saying...
You should probably do that anyway.
Always do. Even now, just carry the bats and clubs.
Yeah.
And residents began staying with friends rather than sleeping alone. The police department received numerous calls of people reporting having physical evidence now, ranging from footprints being found under windows to tears being found in window screens. And you know how the word tears is also the same as tears?
Mm-hmm.
So at first I saw tears on window screens and I said, is he crying? And then I was like, tears.
It's like for the longest time that shampoo that's like, it's no tears. I thought it was no tears. Because it's tangly hair.
Yeah, of course.
Not tearing it. And I was like, my hair's still knotty as fuck. I don't know what you're talking about.
This isn't working.
And then it's no tears.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Some little fish.
Some people reported seeing, quote, two demon-like eyes shining out of the darkness.
Oh, God, it's getting away from us now.
So the police started making calls around looking for a possible suspect. Calls were made to mental hospitals to see if any dangerous patients had been recently released, and any who had an obsession with poison gas.
No, oh, yes. Those damn gassers.
They assembled a list of possible suspects up to this point. So the list included the escaped mental hospital patients, maybe a disgruntled high school chemistry teacher.
What the fuck?
A violent prankster, or maybe even Nazi or Japanese prisoners of war.
Okay.
So up to this point, the Daily Illini, I guess it's a newspaper for Illinois, had reported that 33 people had experienced the strange gas. By September 12th, police had received so many false calls, such as citizens believing they smelled gas or had seen the prowler, that they reduced the priority of these reports, trying to downplay the severity. They tried to explain it all away, trying to say that the smell could have been spilled nail polish, as was evident in one case, or it could be local animals, or it could be the local factory, all of which could be producing this odor. Especially topped with the fact that none of the injuries had been long-term, as every victim recovered from their symptoms pretty quickly, the cops were just kind of, like, not caring that much anymore. So they tried to say that the whole incident was just a result of explainable occurrences exacerbated by public fears and a sign of anxiety that women were feeling while their men were away for war service.
Of fucking course.
Yes. And one of the things that happened, too, that, like, really, like, pissed this guy off, this chief, he was giving his speech on, like, September 12th, and one lady in the crowd screams and stands up and says, "I've just been gassed," and falls to the ground. Everyone looks around. They're like, "There's no one here." Like, what? So he got, like, really pissed from that. But so pretty soon, Chief of Police Cole made a statement saying that he would arrest anyone that claimed to be a victim of the gasser unless they first underwent medical examination. So, like, victim blaming to the highest degree. And I'm sure you'd be shocked to hear that after this announcement, reports of gasser attacks drastically declined.
I'm sure.
So Cole went even further and said that, in fact, there hadn't been any attacks at all, and that the incidents were probably just triggered by chemicals carried on the wind by the nearby industrial factories and then exacerbated by public panic.
Okay, or?
So up to this point, this is a list of victims and dates that we have. So August 31st, one attack. September 1st, three attacks. September 5th, two. September 6th, 7. September 7th, 1. September 8th, 1. September 9th, 2. September 10th, 3. So up to that point, 20 total attacks with more than one victim per each attack. So that's how we have, like, the 33 victims.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm going to say math ain't mathin'.
I knew I had to explain it. And as quickly as the attack started, they stopped. With the last attack...
Well, they were threatened within an inch of their life that if they said anything, they'd get in trouble.
Right. So the last one occurred on September 13th to Miss Bertha Bench and her son Orville. I know. I have someone in my, like, distant relative named Orville.
Nice.
Yeah. Not Redenbacher, or we'd be real rich. So
one would hope.
So the Bench family described the attacker as being a woman who was dressed in men's clothing and that they had been sprayed through their bedroom window with what was described as a filt gun. So this is an agricultural tool used to spray pesticide, and it is said that the attacker was using this to expel the gas. The next morning, footprints did appear in the dirt below their window, like they did find footprints. The prints appeared to have been made by a woman's high-heeled shoe.
Ooh.
Yes. So the benches marked...
So Madame Gasser.
Oh, yeah, Madame Gasser. The benches marked the 21st and final gas attack to occur in Mattoon. So in the end, the attacker was never caught, and no one was ever tried for the attacks. But of course, the theories about who and what it is have gone wild. So let's get into those, shall we?
No kidding.
So this first theory comes mainly from local commissioner of public health Thomas V. Wright 2 weeks after the attacks began. He believes it is mass hysteria. So he said that there had undoubtedly been gassing attacks, but the huge increase in number was probably due to mass hysteria.
It's probably partially true.
Yeah. Residents heard these alarming stories, then started to panic when there was any out-of-place smell or a random shadow in the window. He said, quote, "Someone is going to get killed and it won't be from gas. The people here have lost control of themselves in a manner which is almost unbelievable in a modern world. I wouldn't walk through anyone's backyard for $10,000.
Just wait.
Sir, it's calm there. Chief of Police Cole said, quote, "I'm tired of being dragged out of bed in the middle of the night every night. There's more than one madman in Mattoon. There's 15,000 of them. What we've got here is mass hysteria."
Isn't the population like 1,600?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he's saying everyone here because of the mass hysteria.
Yeah.
Then in 1945, this theory was further validated when Donald M. Johnson wrote a piece titled "The Phantom Anesthetist," the other word that we said before.
Anesthetist?
Anesthetist. Yes, thank you. Titled The Phantom Anesthetist of Mattoon. It was published in the Journal of Abnormal and Social Psychology.
Nice.
His piece was a case study on mass hysteria, saying that what happened in Mattoon was a too perfect of an example of this.
Okay.
In 1959, his opinion was seconded by psychologist James P. Chaplin. This pretty much served as the base for any additional studies done on the phenomenon of mass hysteria. Mattoon was being used as a literal textbook example of it.
Damn.
Of a mass psychogenic illness, about how it spreads, how it's fueled by fear, carried by neighborhood social vectors, and amplified and given shape by local media.
Mm-hmm.
Chaplin wrote in his 1959 book, Rumor, Fear, and the Madness of Crowds, that Mattoon, quote, probably represents one of the purest outbreaks of mass hysteria on record.
Have you seen the Kate Middleton stuff?
Yes!
People are still saying that it's not her that was in the video. And I was like, give it a rest. We've all moved on.
It is interesting.
Yeah, but now that we had the video, most people are like, okay, we're going to leave her alone because she has cancer.
Yeah.
And I still see a couple of people that are like, I knew this wasn't her, it's Beau. And I was like, move on.
You always have to have your conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
And as for the symptoms that people experience, such as the choking, swelling of mucous membrane, and weakness or temporary paralysis, all of that can apparently be from hysteria.
I mean, makes sense.
Right. So there have been other cases of mass hysteria that many people tried to point to explain the situation as well. So in July of 1518, a dancing plague hit Strasbourg, France. So a large number of people started dancing in the streets for days and days on end, not stopping to eat, sleep, or drink. Some of the dancers eventually dropped dead from exhaustion.
I wish we could still have moments like this.
Of dancing plagues?
It seems so wholesome compared to what's happening.
And then they die.
Well, not that part. But, you know, like a mass hysteria, but no one gets hurt.
Yeah, like everyone's like, just like really happy for a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't get those.
No, we don't.
Because we have the internet.
That's true.
We can prove it false or true too fast.
Yeah. In 1692, young girls in Salem, Massachusetts started to have fits. Obviously, it was blamed on witches, and we know what happened after that. In November of 1938, two women reported that in Halifax, England, they had been attacked by a mysterious man wielding a mallet and having bright buckles on his shoes. Within days of the first report, other reports started popping up of similar attacks. Then one of the first victims came forward and confessed that she had injured herself, all to gain some attention, and that there had never been an attacker.
Ooh!
She and several others went to prison on convictions of causing public mischief.
Wow.
And there have been outbreaks all throughout time and all over the world of mass laughing, mass fainting, all of which follow the path of mass hysteria. So that's our first theory. So our next theory is toxic waste or pollution. So on September 12th, Chief of Police Cole had a press conference, like I said. September 12th was a big day in this town.
I could see that.
Where he said that the odors and symptoms that people were experiencing may have been a result of pollutants or toxic waste that were being released by nearby industrial plants, mainly the Atlas Imperial Diesel Engine Company.
That doesn't smell sweet.
I'll get to it.
Okay.
So he speculated that carbon tetrachloride and... I did really good on that first one. He speculated that carbon... tetrachloride and trichloroethylene may have been the substances that were being released by the company, as both have a sweet odor and can produce symptoms similar to those that were being reported. But in response to this, Atlas Imperial Diesel Engine Company, the company implicated, released a statement of their own saying that their facility had only 5 gallons of carbon tetrachloride in stock, which was contained in firefighting equipment, so I guess very well contained. They also denied that any quantities of the chemical could be responsible for the sickness in the town, saying that it would have taken significant quantities of the chemical to sicken the townspeople, and that if this were the case, the factory employees would have been experiencing these symptoms long before anyone outside had been affected.
Facts.
And no one at the company had gotten sick.
Facts.
And at this time, the plant had been certified as safe by the State Department of Health. So there were some who briefly threw around the theory that the gassing was the work of the government, testing a poison gas for later use on German and Japanese forces. Because remember, we're still in World War II. We're in wartime here.
That's what the blobs were.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There are some researchers, though, who have concluded that at least one of the attacks was the work of an actual gasser, which leads us to our next theory that there is an actual assailant. Scott Maruna, a high school chemistry and physics teacher in Jacksonville, wrote about the events in his book, The Mad Gasser of Mattoon, Dispelling the Hysteria. He believes that there truly was a gasser by the name of Farley Llewellyn. Farley was known as the town genius and could be found with, quote, his nose buried in books while at his family's grocery store. But Farley often felt ostracized by the community, not because he drank too much, which he did, but because it was believed that he was homosexual. Mm-hmm. But that's not why he was thought of as the gasser. Not that part. He was believed to be the gasser because Farley had graduated from the University of Illinois with a chemistry degree.
Okay.
And he had a secret lab where he did experiments with various chemicals.
How do they know if it's a secret?
Well, it was a secret lab. Now it's just a lab. There was even an instance where he caused an explosion in his lab that shook the whole neighborhood.
Well, it's a small-ass town. I don't think it would take much.
Maruna said, quote, "Farley, the obvious chemical genius behind the gases synthesis, was the real gasser. In a fit brought on by mental instability and years of pent-up rage against the town that would not and could not accept him, Farley tinkered and toyed with various organic solvents in an attempt to create for a suitable weapon."
Sounds like he had a reason.
Yeah. So Maruna said that Farley's mainly used chemical was tetrachlorethane, which has properties that induce the symptoms reported by the victims. Farley wanted revenge against the residents who had ostracized him for being homosexual.
Of the things he could have done?
Right!
Like you not being able to move for a little bit?
Right.
You'll be all right.
And physically, Farley was tall and thin, matching the Kearney's description of the gasser. So he had been suspected and placed under observation while the attacks were going on.
Goddamn.
He was followed and surveilled, and even then the attacks continued.
And I'm sure they still followed him even after that.
They believed that these attacks after he had been followed were just copycat attackers.
Of course.
Yes. So right around him being suspected, he ended up in a sanitarium for the rest of his days before passing away in 1984. I know.
That's so fucked.
I know. And his lab was investigated and searched, but no such substance was found.
Oh, so it's almost like maybe he didn't do it.
Right.
It's like when they drown the witch and be like, oh, she's dead. She's not a witch.
Right. If you're able to swim up to the top, you're a witch. If you drown, you're not a witch.
But you're dead.
Right.
Sucks to suck.
So then we have the fun theories. So there are some paranormal writers who have covered the events that took place in Mattoon. Actually, a lot of paranormal writers wrote about this. So Lauren Coleman, who writes for Mysterious America, says that the gasser may be a not quite human, possibly extraterrestrial being.
Of course.
John Dowse, who writes for Fortean Times, stated that the gasser was reportedly wearing, quote, a strange metal helmet or mask. So obviously that meant that it was an alien who came down to test a new device on an unsuspecting populace.
I have so many thoughts about this whole, like, aliens popping by but not really staying. Because I'm like, why?
They're in the ocean.
Like, what?
We're really not that interesting.
Right. Well, and I'm just like, why haven't they said anything?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It's all sketch.
So the gasser was said to vanish into thin air. Could thin air be another dimension? There are quite a few who believe that the gasser was not only a stranger to our world, but to our entire plane of existence.
Possibly.
Another
that
theory.
That seems the most logical to me.
I do like that one.
Interdisciplinary. No.
Interdimensional. You're interdisciplinary. This is interdimensional.
Yes, exactly.
Another theory passed around is that the gasser was Bigfoot.
Wow, Bigfoot has really moved on up since his beginning.
Exemplar, he's now a gasser. Exemplar said, quote, "Bigfoot had strayed from its natural habitat and somehow obtained a degree in organic chemistry."
What the fuck?
Like, I was making fun of the Bigfoot theory.
Okay, good.
Yeah, no, he's like, yeah, come on. So those are my favorite theories. So while the validity of this gasser is unknown, there have been others in history showing that the incident in Mattoon wasn't the first and definitely won't be the last. So in 1933 to 1934, Botetourt County in Virginia experienced a gasser. The figure was clad in black, wearing heeled shoes, and described as both a man and a woman. Whole families were being immobilized and sickened by a sweet-tasting gas. Some of the illnesses in this go-around were life-threatening, though. Mm. So Alice Huffman became so ill that a physician had to administer artificial respiration to resuscitate her.
Oh, my God.
Again, panic ensued. A vigilante mob was formed. Mass hysteria. $500 reward was offered for any information to catch the attacker. The Virginia State Assembly passed a law that said, quote, "If people were hurt, a gasser would be deemed guilty of malicious wounding and punished with from between 1 to 20 years in the penitentiary."
That's such a range.
1 to 20. No one was ever caught. No one was ever found guilty. In 1837, there was Spring-Heeled Jack. We could do a whole thing on him. But he was a figure who would pop up at women's doors, spit fire at them, assault them, then bound away.
When you say spit fire.
I don't know. That's what the article said. And I didn't look into him more because he's like a whole thing.
Yeah.
So again, mass hysteria.
Okay.
So there have been other reports of gassers who caused mass hysteria, but none as profound as the attacks that did or did not happen in Mattoon. Mm. So there you have it. The wired and weird tale of the mad gasser of Mattoon.
Wow.
What do we think?
That sounds like a Scooby-Doo character.
It does. It does. Mad gasser.
Mad gas.
It weren't for you meddling kids.
I think it happened.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there was also mass hysteria.
Yeah.
So I think it was a little bit of both.
I do too. I think some of the attacks maybe didn't happen.
Yeah.
But I definitely think something was going on.
I think it's the typical, like, it's taken seriously until they start getting the fake reports and then they just assume everyone's are made up.
I do really, though, like the alien theory.
I mean,
I really like the interdimensional theory.
Yeah.
And the Bigfoot one, I think they went with that one because that one lady was like, it was an ape-like person.
Yeah, but she was the only one.
Right. But so they were like, ape-like? Bigfoot?
Bigfoot. It's always Bigfoot.
Always Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Bigfoot or aliens.
If they're not in the theories.
Right.
Then you're right. It didn't happen.
But yeah, so no one died.
That's good.
This was a weird one. So I remember last time we did Illinois, I texted you and I said, hey, if you don't have a case to do yet, this one's interesting. Mm. But then you had found a case. And so I completely forgot about it. And then when we came around this time, I found it again. I was like, this is what I told Mackenzie to research.
Well, I had no idea.
I know.
Didn't remember that.
Yeah.
At all.
I didn't remember it until I was walking around work today. And I said, I told Mackenzie.
Still don't, even with you saying it. I'm just going to go ahead and believe you.
That's all you can do at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You could check your text messages and see. Mad gasser.
Well, I believe you, so I don't do that. I do know that when I do remember, I'm right.
It stuck.
Because
you don't remember a lot of things. So the ones that do stay, they're there. But yeah. So the fun.
That's interesting.
I thought it was a fun tale.
I like that.
Yeah.
I think that story, like, could be a fun way to start off a whole bunch of different kinds of things. Like robbing people. Killing people.
Criminal Minds episode.
Criminal Minds episode. I was thinking of all the different possibilities.
Or just semi-harmless. It's making people paralyzed for 30 minutes to 90.
What if they're paralyzed with fear?
That could be too.
It was all
psychological.
In there.
All there.
Well, that was an interesting story.
Thank you.
That was fun. I liked
Thank you.
It.
I did too.
Yeah.
It was a little nice pivot away from like last week.
Blobs and gas. Your story.
Yeah. Yeah. Blobs and gas.
Blobs and gas.
Well, thank you for listening.
Yeah.
As always, rate and review us.
We got to start saying this at the beginning.
We do, because people are probably like, okay, I can skip to the end now.
Yeah, probably no one hears us when we say these things.
All right, we'll say it at the beginning. Also, send us your scary stories to ascarystatepodcast@gmail.com.
Yes.
And I don't think we have anything else for you.
Tell your friends, tell your family,
tell your
coworkers.
Tell
also
everybody.
Also, social media.
What? Oh, social media.
So follow us on social media. And yeah, stay scary.
Stay safe.
I beat you to it.